Well, Brian, welcome to Australia and to the Australian National University. Can I too acknowledge we're meeting on traditional lands, the Ngunnawal people, and pay my respects to their elders past and present, and also mention to people that there is a candlelit vigil at Union Court at 7:30 for Andrew Chan and Myuran Sukumaran. So those who can attend, I'm sure, would be a good event to move to. Brian, of course, there's perhaps no more apt country than Australia to be talking about just mercy. As you well know, English settlement in Australia begins with an absence of just mercy. Some of the first settlers to Australia and presumably some of the ancestors of those in the audience were transported for crimes as heinous as stealing a block of cheese, a mirror, a chicken. The youngest transportee in the First Fleet was a chimney sweep transported at age 13 who had been imprisoned for 4 years from age 9 at the time of transportation. So Australian white settlement is founded on some of the sort of issues you talk about here. But in your extraordinary page-turner of a book, there's the story of Walter McMillan that flows right through the book. And I wonder if you might just start by telling us a little about the story of Mr. McMillan.
Yeah. Well, as a young lawyer, I was working on death penalty cases throughout the South and became increasingly focused on Alabama. And we decided to open a project in Montgomery, Alabama, because Alabama didn't have any resources for people who were on death row. And there were dozens of people there literally dying for legal assistance. I chose to write about Walter McMillan's case because his case, in some ways, was an emblem of all of these problems in the American criminal justice system. He was an African-American man who had been accused of committing a murder, and he was quickly convicted, quickly sentenced to die, and then was on death row when I met him. And when I started looking at the case, I was just astonished by all of the problems that were emerged. He had said persistently that he was innocent, and it turns out that at the time of the crime, he was actually at his sister's house raising money, at his house actually, raising money for his sister's church. And there were about 30 people of color who were there with him. So the entire black community knew he was innocent. And yet he was arrested. This murder took place in downtown Monroeville. They couldn't figure out who committed it. Gun sales went up. People were very complaining a lot about the police. And we think they made an arrest of Mr. McMillan not because he was somebody who you would suspect of murder, he had no prior criminal history, but because he was having an affair with a young white woman. And this was what provoked so many people that they arrested him. They ignored all of the people of color who said he couldn't have committed the crime because he was with them. They actually put him on death row before the trial. He spent 15 months on death row awaiting trial. It's the only case I've ever had where the client was on death row pre-trial. The papers would say death row defendant Walter McMillan will be arraigned next week, will be charged next week, will file these kinds of motions. And it had these astonishing features. When I got involved, there was a judge whose name was Robert E. Lee Key, who overrode the jury's verdict of life and imposed the death penalty. We have an elected judicial system where our elected judges can change the jury's verdict of life to death. And about 25% of the people on death row in Alabama got life verdicts that got converted to death. And when I took the case, the judge called me and really tried to dissuade me from representing Mr. McMillan, made these kinds of veiled threats. But the most astonishing irony for me was that Monroeville, where this crime took place, is the community where Harper Lee grew up and wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, the very famous American novel about a lawyer who defends an innocent black man who is wrongly convicted. And if you go to Monroeville, you see a community that just kind of completely preoccupied with the story of To Kill a Mockingbird. All of the streets are named after characters in the book. You go to the restaurant, you have to get a Boo Radley sandwich or an Atticus Finch shake and all of this sort of thing. They love that story. They have a team of people that put on the play about it. They converted the courthouse into a museum. And when I first went there, everybody kept saying, oh, go to the To Kill a Mockingbird Museum. You can stand where Gregory Peck stood when he made the movie. And I was saying, no, I'm too busy. I've got this innocent black man who's facing the death penalty. And there was this astonishing indifference to the plight of this man's case, even in a community that knew this story so well. And we got such resistance. I had all kinds of people threatening. We got bomb threats at the office. I had death threats and all of this just because we were trying to win relief for him. And I thought it was an important case to story to talk about because in a lot of ways there is this disconnect in American criminal justice. We have these ideas that we talk about. We go all over the world talking about justice and all these things, and yet we tolerate so much injustice, so much inequality. And this community was a microcosm of this, celebrating To Kill a Mockingbird while perpetuating this incredibly gross miscarriage of justice that led many people of color in that community to feel like they had been convicted too. It wasn't just the conviction and death sentence of a single person. It felt like everybody of color felt like they had been condemned. And that despair that came from that condemnation was something I really felt the need to talk about.
And you ultimately succeeded where Atticus Finch did not.
You know, the comparisons to Atticus Finch weren't entirely comfortable for me because I do think that effective lawyering has to aspire to get the client out, particularly when the client is innocent. And it always bothered me. I identified with Tom Robinson when I read the book, and it wasn't entirely satisfactory to me that he died from hopelessness.
But then ultimately, Mr. McMillan doesn't get much in the way of damages. And one of the issues you talk a bit about in the book is how little one can claim for wrongful imprisonment. I think you talk about New Hampshire, where if I get injured driving my car into a pothole, I can get $500,000. But if I'm wrongfully imprisoned for a decade, I'm capped at $25,000.
There are many states that don't provide you with anything. At that time, Alabama didn't provide anything. And it's one of the, again, defects, I think, in the way we've oriented ourselves to inequality and injustice. We don't apologize. We don't compensate. We don't reflect. We just move on. And I think that tendency to move on is what's given rise to so much continuing problems. And these problems, I think, create real despair in communities that have been especially vulnerable to this problem of wrongful conviction, poor communities, communities of color.
Do you see that changing? Is Equal Justice Initiative working on those wrongful imprisonment caps?
We are. We eventually got money for Mr. McMillan because we sued and we were able to show that they had illegally put him on death row. Even if you had assumed that the conviction was valid, you can't put a person on death row before the crime, before the trial. The interesting thing about the McMillan case, they coerced people to testify falsely against him, and for some bizarre reason, they tape recorded the sessions when they were coercing the witnesses to testify falsely. Even more bizarre, they didn't get rid of the tapes after the trial was over. And so I actually found these tapes when I started investigating the case, and I write in my book about this old car I used to drive, which didn't do anything right, actually, but I was renting cars because we were getting so many threats that I couldn't go into the community in my car. And back in the day, this was during the time when they were cassette tapes. I guess they had those, the way they have those everywhere, but you don't find anybody. I told my students about a cassette tape. They looked at me with this blank expression. But they had these cars that had auto-reverse cassette tape players. And I thought I had these, I found these tapes, and I put the first one in and it didn't have anything useful on it. And then it clicked and it flipped over. And I heard the main witness against Mr. McMillan being interrogated. And the first thing he said to the police officers was, quote, "You want me to frame an innocent man for murder, and I don't feel right about that." And the police officer said, "Well, if you don't give us what we want, we're going to put you on death row, too." And so they did. And it went on like that for 45 minutes, where he kept saying, "But he's innocent. I don't know anything. You want me to frame an innocent man?" And we got these tapes and ultimately used those as evidence to win Mr. McMillan's freedom.
But the thing that comes through so strongly in the book is that you expected that as soon as you brought forward that evidence, the charges would be dropped, and the charges weren't dropped.
Yeah.
Why was that, do you think?
Well, I think we've really been acculturated in America to be completely comfortable with these kinds of outliers, these kinds of excess. I think you can't really understand it without understanding the broader picture. And America has, as was indicated, in my judgment, been corrupted by the politics of fear and anger. We had politicians in the 1970s that began competing with each other over who could be toughest on crime. Our prison population had been stable for many years, and all of a sudden we engaged in this campaign to put as many people in jail or prison as possible. And the prison population went from about 300,000 in 1972 to 2.3 million today. We now have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, some 6 million people on probation or parole, 5% of the world's population, 25% other world in prison. And with that kind of system, you don't worry too much about evidence of innocence and evidence of unfairness. And it really has corrupted our sensibilities. And so when I presented this evidence, people were quite non-responsive. And I think one of the great challenges that we face today is that when a society becomes indifferent to its abuse of its citizens, when it becomes indifferent to wrongful conviction, it is a society in peril. Because you measure, in my judgment, the commitment to the rule of law, the civility of a community, its character, not by how it treats powerful people and rich people and privileged people. I think you judge the character of a society by how it treats the poor and the incarcerated and the condemned. When I come to Australia, I'm dazzled when I was walking around Sydney by some of the things I've seen. This is a beautiful capital city, but I can't judge this community, this country, by how it treats its rich and the powerful and the politicians I was on TV with. None of that. I think you judge a country by how it treats the people who are poor and incarcerated, the Aboriginals, the Indigenous. Those are the people and the places and the spaces where you judge how a society is faring. And when I go to America and I see this indifference to wrongful conviction, I very much worry about our future.
And Hillary Clinton at one point talked about these as the invisible people in American society. For Australia, it was 1967 when we last put somebody to death, Ronald Ryan hanged by the Bolte government. So anyone under 48 in Australia hasn't been alive when we carried out an execution. But now you're here at this time when Australia is again talking about the death penalty being imposed on Andrew Chen and Myuran Sukumaran. And you must have thought hard about the question as to how Australia might, even at this late stage, bring some pressure to bear on Indonesia. What are the arguments that you think we ought to be making towards Indonesia?
Well, I think it's something that requires kind of a long-standing principled approach. It's really hard when you're in the waning hours before an execution to effectuate the kind of circumstance that best protects people. And so I've been really insistent in my work on these topics in getting governments to be more vigilant and protecting basic human rights. There was a time before 2001 where foreign governments never extradited people back to the States if there was any risk at all that they would face the death penalty. And we use this power of non-extradition to protect people from these abuses. That kind of lapsed a little bit after the 9/11 attacks, and I've seen governments become a lot more casual about that. I think we should continue to insist on that. If we know someone's going to be tortured or abused or executed, I think we have an obligation to not extradite that person back to the country. Then I think we have to demand that countries provide the same respect and fair treatment to foreign nationals that they provide to their own citizens. One of the ironies about this situation in Indonesia is that the government is spending money to shield Indonesian nationals from the death penalty in other countries, but executing people who are disproportionately foreign nationals in their own homeland. So I think that's something we have to really push hard on. And I actually believe that boycotts and economic influence is a critical component to advancing human rights. South Africa did not end apartheid simply by moral argument alone. It was the boycotts and the economic pressures. In America, I'm a product of the civil rights movement. I started my education in a black school, a colored school, because the public schools weren't open to black children. And the civil rights movement that inspired and transformed our country was courage and leadership, but also economic boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott that led to transformation in Montgomery was inspired by Rosa Parks' action, but it was then supported by a year-long boycott of the buses. And I think sometimes we have to express economically what is not being heard morally and politically. And I don't think that's an inappropriate thing. I actually think it's an empowering thing when society says, you know what, I can inconvenience myself, I can create a little bit of discomfort in advance in service of justice. I think that not only empowers a society, but it actually plugs you in to your higher values. And I hope something like that is considered here in Australia.
You write in the book about being at the execution of one of your clients, Herbert Richardson. What is it? What's it like to be at an execution?
You know, it's one of the real surreal parts of this topic. And I think, you know, anybody who gets close to it begins to see things and hear things and understand things that are hard to understand otherwise. Herbert Richardson was the first person I ever represented. And we got in this case very late And it was frustrating because we opened up this office and this man called me and he said, Mr. Stevenson, I have an execution date in 30 days. And I had to tell him, I'm sorry that we don't have books or staff, or we had just opened our office. And I said, I can't take any cases yet. We're just not quite ready for that. And he said, but I have an execution date. And I sighed really heavily and I said, I'm sorry, I just don't know how we could take on a case. And he hung up the phone very quickly and I was really unnerved by that. Really didn't sleep at all. Came back the next day and he called me again and he said, Mr. Stevenson, I'm begging you, please take my case. He said, you don't have to tell me you can win. You don't have to tell me you can stop them from executing me. But he said, I don't think I can make it these next 29 days if there's no hope at all. When he put it like that, I couldn't say no, so I said yes. And we tried really hard to get a stay of execution, but every court we went to said too late. In the States, we have this preference for finality over fairness, and every court said too late, too late, too late. And finally, on the day of the execution, I got that dreaded last call from the Supreme Court denying our stay motion. And I went down to Atmore, Alabama, to be with this man, and it was surreal. It was just nothing had prepared me for this. His family was there. The family did not want to leave. He had married a woman who just said, I'm not going to leave you. And the guards were trying to navigate that, and they couldn't figure out how to do it. And they were asking me to help them get the family out so that they wouldn't become physical or violent. And after they left, we were back there. And I had this conversation with him I've never forgotten. He was telling me about his day. And he kept saying to me, Brian, it's been such a strange day. The guards had come in earlier and shaved the hair off his body because we used the electric chair. And to effectuate these executions, they would shave people so that their bodies were better conduits of this electricity. It was really horrible. And you could tell when the guards were shaving him that they felt ashamed to be doing something so inhumane. And it was humiliating to Herbert. And after they left, he came up to me, he says, it's been such a strange day, Brian. He says, all day long, people have been saying, what can I do to help you? He said, when I woke up this morning, the guards came to me and said, what can we get you for breakfast? At midday, they came to me and said, what can we get you for lunch? In the evening, they came to me and said, what can we get you for dinner? Can we get you the stamps to mail your last letters? Can we get you the phone? Can we get you water? Can we get you coffee? And I'll never forget him saying to me in those last few minutes, he said, Brian, it's been so strange. More people have said, what can I do to help you in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did in the first 19 years of my life? And I thought about that and I started thinking, where were they when you had returned from Vietnam traumatized by war? Where were they when you were drug addicted? Where were they when your mother died and you were suffering? Where were they when you were homeless and roaming the streets? And with those questions running through my mind, they pulled him away, strapped him in the electric chair, and executed him. There really is no way to reconcile yourself with that kind of act, to be honest. But what astonished me was how everybody was moving around, and there was a clear sense that they all knew it was wrong. They all knew that this was shameful, and yet they continued nonetheless. And I think one of the really truly unjust things we do is to put somebody in a position where they have to kill another healthy human being and expect them to be okay with that. You know, we don't rape people who are convicted of rape because it would be unconscionable to expect a healthy human being to do that. We don't torture those who torture. We don't abuse those who abuse. But we think we can kill people who kill because there's some way to do it that doesn't implicate us. And I don't think there's such a way. I think when we kill, and particularly when we kill in the name of the citizens, we demean ourselves. I think we undermine our ability to be just human beings who prioritize just human relationships.
Talk to me about why the death penalty is such a signal issue for you, given the scale of the US justice system. Yeah. So 16,000 homicides a year, 11,000 by gun, 2 million people in jail, 1 in 3 African Americans born this century will spend time in jail. And then last year, there were only 35 people executed. Mm. On the scale of wrongs, what is it about that brings the death penalty to the fore for you?
Well, you're right that the number of people who are directly affected is smaller, but I think the character of taking a human being and executing them is greater. Mm. And there's really no way to account for that. You know, and so for me, it's the most fundamental right, this right to kind of have life. But also, I think the reason why I see this as a priority issue is because there is this long history that the death penalty is connected to. You know, my work around the death penalty is actually informed by my work around racial justice. And my grandmother was the daughter of people who were enslaved, and the legacy of slavery has never really been addressed in America. I think that we have been burdened in our country by this shadow, this ugly shadow, which is still cast by slavery. We weren't, like a lot of other countries across the globe, we weren't a society with slavery. We became a slave society in the United States. We created a narrative of racial difference to justify and defend enslavement. And for decades and centuries, we had this narrative of racial, these black people, they're not as smart as everybody else, they're not as good as everybody else. And that created this world that we've never really corrected, because the true evil of slavery wasn't involuntary servitude, it was this narrative of racial difference. And that's why I don't believe that slavery ended in America, it just evolved, it turned into something else. And we had decades of terrorism with lynching and violence and this kind of abuse of people of color, so terrorized people of color that they fled to other communities. And when the pressure got on American in these southern states around lynching, what they switched to was the death penalty. It was the replacement for lynching. And we had all of these executions between 1930 and 1972 disproportionately applied to people of color. And we've never accounted for that narrative. And so for me, the death penalty is an expression of all of the misguided judgments that were born in slavery, that were sustained by terrorism and lynching, that were continued under the era of segregation. And we cannot be indifferent to it. And even though the people who are executed are not all people of color, its roots are in something corrupt. Its roots are in something corrupt. And so for me, it becomes necessary to talk about it. But also, as a human being, I am persuaded that our own respect for basic humanity cannot be tolerant of something like the death penalty. I really do think the question of the death penalty is not do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed, but do we deserve to kill? And when you have a system of justice like ours that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent, when you have a system that's been undermined by racial bias, when you prey on children and mentally ill people and people who are frail and vulnerable and poor, then you do not, in my judgment, deserve to kill. And then finally, I think that the death penalty, and my clients have taught me this more than anything, we need to be more kind of reflective about human quality, human characteristic. You know, I'm persuaded that we're all more than our worst mistakes, that each of us is more than these young men in Bali are not just drug dealers. They're not. There's something else there. I think if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I think if they take something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. Even if you kill somebody, you're not just a killer. There's something more there. And when you execute someone, you don't just execute that part of them that committed a crime. You execute all these other things that are filled with human dignity and beauty and responsibility and redemptive potential. And to kill things that have redemptive potential and have beauty and dignity is inherently, in my judgment, incompatible with justice. And so you cannot be silent when people are being executed. You cannot look away when people are being condemned. And you cannot have justice, no matter how many people you get out of jails or prisons for other crimes, when you're executing folks.
And there was the story for me of George Stinney, the 14-year-old boy executed in 1944 encapsulated much of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Can you tell us that?
Sure, yeah. He was one of the children, one of the youngest children who was executed. It was a little kid who was living in a town in South Carolina where two young girls went missing. And he had seen these children. They asked him where they could find flowers, and he directed them. And when they went missing that night, the whole town formed a search party and went looking for these kids. And at some point, he told them that he had seen these girls. And because he was the last person to see them, and he was a little black kid, he was arrested and charged with their murders when their bodies were found a day later. They ran his family out of town. They wouldn't let any people of color near the courthouse. They tried him in a show trial that lasted less than a few hours. And then they gave him the death penalty. And even though he was 14 years old and too small to fit into the electric chair, they actually put Bibles on the chair so that he could be tall enough to get the thing on his head. And then he was electrocuted in 1944. And it created, in many ways, this kind of setup for the work that we've been doing around children, because we also have narratives in America that have continued to demonize kids. We've got some 250,000 people in our prisons right now serving long prison sentences for crimes they committed when they were children. We've got 10,000 children on any given day in an adult jail or prison, 3,000 children sentenced to die in prison for crimes, some as young as 13 and 14 years of age. And I write about George Stinney because we've never accounted for the barbarity of that execution. We've never owned up to it. And we've left ourselves vulnerable to now decades of continued exploitation and abuse of children. The United States is the only country in the world besides Somalia that has refused to sign the Covenant on the Rights of the Child, the U.S. and Somalia. And the reason why we won't sign it is because it bans the death penalty and life sentences for children. And we undermine our ability to do human rights work around the world when we leave ourselves vulnerable to these accusations, which are legitimate, that we don't care about our children.
It always seems strange to me that parliamentarians on the conservative side who speak about family values are nonetheless comfortable with locking up people who are very young or parents. And there's so many prisoners who are themselves leaving kids without mums or dads outside. To what extent is that family values argument potentially a way in which those of us who believe we've gone too far down the road to incarceration can push back the opposite direction?
Well, I do think we have to change the narrative about what it means to respect family. And I think you're absolutely right that many of these policies have been absolutely disastrous when it comes to really trying to promote family values. And you've got these issues about refugee children. In this country, there has been, I think, a tendency to kind of demonize children in a bunch of societies that has left us vulnerable. And that's certainly true in the States. We have a tremendous increase in the number of women being sent to prison in America, 640% increase in the number of women being sent to prison, 70% of whom are single parents with minor children. And when we put these women in prison, we condemn their children to displacement and foster care situations. So I do think we've got to talk about that. But I think ultimately we have to kind of change the narrative about what it means to be a child in an adult prison. I talk about this because I met a little boy when I was a young lawyer. My clients were getting younger and younger, and I had a case where a child was arrested and put in an adult prison. His grandmother called me, and I got involved. And this boy was the daughter of a woman who had been abused by her boyfriend. And the man would get drunk sometimes and come home and just become abusive. And he'd been drinking one day, and he came home, and he called the boy's mother into the kitchen. She went in there, and he just walked up to her and punched her in the face, knocked her unconscious. She was lying on the floor bleeding. And the little boy ran in, tried to get his mom to wake up. She was covered with blood. And this child thought his mom was dead. She wasn't dead, but he thought his mom was dead. And the little boy tried for 15 minutes, and after that he got up, he walked into the bedroom where the man had gone inside and fallen asleep, walked over to a dresser drawer where he knew this man kept his handgun. He pulled the gun out, he walked over to where the man was sleeping, pointed the gun at the man, and he stood there. And the man was snoring, and when the man stopped snoring, the child tragically pulled the trigger, shot the man in the head. He died almost instantly. Now, this kid was about 5 feet tall. He was under 100 pounds. He'd never been in trouble before. And he was the kind of kid that probably would have been tried as a juvenile, but for the fact that the man that he shot and killed, his mother's boyfriend, was a sheriff, a deputy sheriff. And because of that, the prosecutor insisted that this child be tried as an adult, and the judge immediately certified him to stand trial as an adult, and they put him in the adult jail. And his grandmother called me after he'd been there for 3 days and asked me to go and see him, and I did. And I had one of those interviews that you sometimes have that are really difficult. The child came out, I started asking questions, and he wouldn't say a word. And at some point, I put my pen down and I said, look, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. You got to talk to me. He kept staring at the wall. And I got up and I walked around the table. I pulled my chair close to him and I said, come on, you got to talk to me. I can't help you if you don't talk to me. And his child just kept staring. And eventually, I didn't know what to do, so I just started leaning on him. I don't even know why, but there was a point where I felt him lean back. And when he leaned back, I put my arm around him and said, come on, you got to talk to me. I can't help you if you don't talk to me. And when I said that, this little boy started to cry. And through his tears, he actually fell into me and began talking to me, not about what happened with his mom, not about what happened with the man, but he started talking to me about what had happened at the jail. And he told me on the first night, several men had hurt him. And then he told me on the next night he'd been raped by several people. Then he told me that so many people had hurt him the night before, he couldn't remember how many there were had been. And I held this little boy while he cried hysterically for almost an hour. When I left that jail, I couldn't help but ask myself, who is responsible for this? And I realized that we are. We Americans are. We've allowed this narrative to corrupt our basic requirement to protect children. And we got that child out of there. We got a decent outcome for him. But it made me realize that we have to actually commit to recognizing that all children are children. And whenever society allows its children to be victimized by its policies that are designed to be tough and to gain political power for some, that is a society that has to be confronted, has to be pushed. And whether we're talking about refugee children in Australia or black and brown children in America, it is one of the great intersections of what it means to be committed to family, to basic family human rights. You cannot tolerate the abuse of children, as we have in our justice system. It's so ironic. You know, in America, you can't drink, you can't smoke, you can't vote, you can't do all of these things, but we can treat you like an adult and put you on death row or give you life without parole sentences. We executed children in America until 2005. And that consciousness has to be confronted, it seems to me, if we're going to make progress on these issues.
As a father of three boys, it was Charlie's story that I found the most affecting part of your book. We had a report in the early 1990s that estimated that one in four young men in Australian jails were sexually assaulted, and yet it seems to be still a topic for jokes in Hollywood movies. How do you go about raising the profile of sexual violence in jails? Is it something you can raise with a judge at sentencing stage, the risk that somebody will be subject to sexual violence in jail?
Yeah, I think one of the it is something, but it's not something that's gotten a lot of responsiveness. I think part of it is just trying to get people to understand that we are all responsible for these things. That is, it's not a person over there, a judge over there, a prosecutor over there. These are basically people who represent us. And if we want something different, we've got to demand that. We've got to stand for that. We've made great progress in changing the way we talk about domestic violence in many societies. It used to be that that was a joke too. And then people began to stand up and say, it's not funny. It's not insignificant. It's not a joke. And the whole society had to change in order for us to make the progress we need to make. And I think the whole society is going to have to change in terms of this conversation about punishment and criminal justice. It's only when we insist that our policymakers provide protections and provide punishments that are appropriate and fair and responsible will we see the kind of changes that we really want.
So, Brian, I was halfway through reading your book when I was driving somewhere and Sweet Home Alabama came on the radio. And it's one of those songs that, you know, I love, but I'm partway through reading your account of how Walter McMillan is treated in the Alabama judicial system, and it didn't sound quite so jolly. How do you feel about the deep South?
Well, you know, I think it is one of the real challenges that we face. We have a campaign where we're trying to change the visual landscape of the South. I mean, it's a place that's celebrates all the wrong things. You know, we have romanticized the defenders of the Confederacy. We've lionized these people who were the architects of slavery and white supremacy. And we have just resisted any effort to own up to that. And one of my great frustrations, you come to Germany, and you see a country that's soberly trying to make to reconcile itself to the history of the Holocaust. You get off a plane there, and you see the stones and the markers and the monuments. You go to the concentration camps, which are incredible spaces for reflection about that horror. And yet, in America, we do the opposite. We still celebrate the people who were the architects of all of this bigotry. And so one of the great challenges we do have is to create a new conversation about that. And it does. It does create a different relationship to these things. I talk a little bit about going to a prison at one point, and I'll be honest, one of my real challenges, because I did grow up in the South, and I grew up in the segregated South, is that I don't like it when I see the Confederate flags. I get provoked when I hear Sweet Home Alabama. It's an infectious melody. I will give it that. But it provokes me that people are celebrating this history that is so at odds. You know, when people talk about the good old days, I can't make sense of that. I don't like the flags. I don't like it. And I was going to a prison, And there was a truck outside this prison, which was like a shrine to the old South. And it had all of these bumper stickers on it. It had all these Confederate flags on it. There was a bumper sticker on this truck I hadn't seen before. The bumper sticker read, quote, "If I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd have picked my own cotton," which was not something I'd ever seen before. And I was really agitated by it. And I walked past this truck, and there was a white guard at the prison door. And I went up to him and said, "Hi, I'm here for a legal visit." And this guard said, "You're not a lawyer." I said, "Oh, yes, sir, I am." He said, and I said, "I've been here before." He said, "No, you're not a lawyer." I said, "No, I am a lawyer." He said, "Well, you're going to have to show me your bar card." And he made me go back to my car and get my bar card. So I actually had to walk past that truck again, get my bar card, and then come back. And I said, "Well, here's my bar card." And I was a little insulted. So I said, "I want to see my client now." He said, "Well, I'm not going to let you into the prison until you go into the bathroom. I'm going to give you a strip search." I said, "No, sir. Lawyers do not get strip search coming into this prison." He said, "You coming into my prison, you're going to get strip search." I couldn't get anybody to help me. And I'd driven 3 hours to be at the prison, so I decided to just kind of deal with it. So I went into the bathroom, let this man subject me to a humiliating strip search. I came back out, was trying to recover some dignity. I said, "Look, I want to see my client now." He said, "Well, you've got to go back there and sign the book." I said, "Lawyers don't have to sign that book. You coming into my prison, you go back there and sign the book." So I did. Eventually, he led me to the door. He unlocked the door, and I was about to walk inside, and he grabbed me by the arm, and he said, "Hey, let me ask you something." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Did you see that truck out there with all those bumper stickers and flags?" I said, "Yeah, I saw that truck." He said, "I want you to know that that's my truck." It just really enraged me. And I went into the prison yard to meet this man I'd never met before. I knew he was disabled, but I'd never met him. I was sitting there just still angry. And this client came in, and he sat down, and the first thing he'd said to me was, quote, "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake?" And I thought to myself, this is the strangest day I've had. I said, "No, I didn't bring you a chocolate milkshake. I'm your lawyer. I'm here to represent you." And I started asking my questions, and about halfway through it, I realized that this man wasn't paying any attention. And I realized he was hung up on this milkshake, and so I went back. I said, "Look, I'm sorry. I didn't know you wanted me to bring you a chocolate milkshake. The next time I come, if they let me, I will bring you a chocolate milkshake." And when I said that, the man smiled and smiled and smiled. He had a horrible history of abuse and neglect, severely disabled person. He was in 29 foster homes by the time he was 10. He developed symptoms of bipolar disorder at 9, 10, and 11. He was schizophrenic at 13, started using crack cocaine at 14, heroin addict at 16, homeless at 17, having psychotic episodes. And in the midst of a psychotic episode, he committed a horrific murder. They convicted him, arrested him, convicted him, charged him with murder, sentenced him to death. The trial lasted a day and a half. I read the record, and at no point in the record did you find the words mental health, mental illness, mental disability. Terrible representation. So we started working on the case and got some pretty powerful evidence about his mental disabilities and put on some of the, found the foster parents who were going to testify. It was time to go to court. And I was excited and hopeful because I thought we had a strong case. And when I got to court, I went through my ritual. I told myself, "I'm sorry I couldn't bring you a chocolate milkshake, but we're going to keep trying." And I looked around, and there in the courtroom, who do I see but this guard who had dealt with me so terribly? And I asked my client if he was okay, and he was fine. We put on our case for about 3 days, and I felt good about it. And about a month later, it was time to go back to the prison just to see the client. And I drove down there, parked my car, and what do I see in the parking lot but that truck? I hadn't dealt with this guy since then. But I saw that truck, and I almost decided to come back a different day. But when I was a little boy, the civil rights people used to sing this song, "Can't Let Nobody Turn Me Around, Turn Me Around." And just when I was about to leave, I started hearing that song in my head. And I said, no, I can't do that. So I got my bar card, and I kind of steeled myself to go deal with this guy. And I walked up to the door, and there, sure enough, there was the guard. And I saw him and said, "Hi, I'm here for a legal visit." He said, "Hello, Mr. Stevenson, how are you?" He threw me. I said, "Well, I'm fine." I said, "Here's my bar card." He said, "Oh, I don't need to see that." I said, "Okay, well, I'm going to go get ready for your search." He said, "Oh, Mr. Stevenson, we're not going to do that." I said, "Well, thank you." I said, "Well, I'll go over here and sign the book." He said, "Mr. Stevenson, I saw you coming, and I signed you in." Really, really. I was kind of just puzzled. I said, "Well, thank you." And he said, "Come on over here, sir. I'm going to let you in." And he took me over to the door, and I was standing there while he tried to unlock the door. It's a padlock and a key. And his hand started to shake. He couldn't get his hands to stop shaking, and he couldn't get the key in the lock. And I was staring, trying to figure out what's going on. And eventually he got the key in the lock. He unlocked the door, and he looked up, and his face was flush red, and he was just shaking. And he said, "Mr. Stevenson, I have to say something. I have to say something." And he looked at me and he said, I want you to know that I was in that courtroom for those 3 days and I was listening. He said, I want you to know I came up in the foster care system too. He said, I didn't think anybody had it as bad as I did, but I realized that maybe your client had it worse than I did. And then he said, I want you to know that I think what you're doing is a good thing. And I hope you keep fighting for justice. Would have never guessed it, never ever. Then he put his hand out and said, sir, can I please shake your hand? And I shook that man's hand and I could not believe what I was seeing, what I was hearing. And I was about to walk inside the prison and he grabbed me by the arm and said, wait, I gotta tell you something else. I said, what's that? He said, well, I just want you to know I did something on the way back from the courthouse to the prison. I said, what'd you do? Well, you know, I took an exit at some point and I just took your client to a Wendy's and I bought him a chocolate milkshake. It's a really silly story, but it speaks to me about the importance of confronting our history, not being so overwhelmed by the ugliness of the images that we stop trying to do the things that have to be done. You know, I think that America can be a stronger country, can be a greater country if we start talking honestly about our history of racial inequality, if we own up to our mistakes, if we commit ourselves to truth and reconciliation. Like every country, there are disparities with the treatment of Aboriginal people in this country, in our prison system. I think we're going to be a stronger Australia when we start talking about the ways we've got to create interventions to disrupt that. I know immigration is a complex issue for lots of people, but you cannot abuse those who are in your space under any circumstance. And we become stronger when we confront that. We just have to be hopeful and believe things we haven't seen. That's what my work has taught me, is that sometimes you have to believe things that you haven't seen.
So there's this lovely tension in your book between the hope, you talk about Vaclav Havel's optimism of the spirit, and the brokenness. You describe yourself as being a broken body.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that tension between what you want to achieve and the toll it takes?
Yeah. I mean you're right, there is a tension there. I think that, you know, as much as we love human rights, as much as we love social justice, as much as we'd love to see societies move forward, we can't actually achieve those things until we choose to do uncomfortable things. That's what my work has taught me. I believe that, you know, you cannot make progress until you choose to do something uncomfortable. And that's hard for us because as human beings, we're programmed to seek comfort. And I like comfort. It's not like I'm opposed to comfort, right? You know, I was giving a talk down in South Mississippi and I got off the plane and these people came up to me and they said, oh, Mr. Stevenson, we know all about you. And we're having a conference at the luxurious DoubleTree Hotel. And we decided you don't want to stay at the luxurious DoubleTree Hotel. And the lady said, so we called one of the farmers and asked him to put you up in the barn. And I said, what is wrong with you? Of course I want to stay at the luxurious DoubleTree Hotel. I like those chocolate chip cookies just like everybody else. That's not what I'm talking about. But at times you do have to choose to do uncomfortable things. And I think the way I make peace with this is to just recognize that for those of us who believe in justice, those of us who really want to see the world change, there's a different metric system that we have to measure ourselves by, how we measure our choices by. It can't be judged, can't be measured by the things that other people think. It can't be measured by how much money you make or how many people know your name or how successful things are. And sometimes the measurement that matters the most is how often we choose to do uncomfortable things that are necessary to advance justice, to protect the people who need to be protected. And I've been taught that by the people that I've met, and I tell this story in the book, and I'll just repeat it. I was giving a talk in a church, actually, and there was an older man that came into the back of the church in a wheelchair. And he was staring at me the whole time I was talking with this very stern look on his face. He looked angry. And I couldn't help but just kind of notice him because he was distracting me because he looked so stern and tough. And I got through my talk and the kids came up, they were fine, but the man kept staring at me in the back. And eventually he got a little boy to wheel him up to me. And the man came up to me and he had this very aggressive look on his face and he got in front of me and he put his finger up and he said, do you know what you're doing? And I didn't know how to respond. I just stepped back. And then he said it again. He said, do you know what you're doing? And I started mumbling something. I don't even know what I said to him. And he said, do you know what you're doing? And then he said to me, he says, I'm going to tell you what you're doing. And this man looked at me. He said, you're beating the drum for justice. And it moved me. It really moved me. He says, you're beating the drum for justice. And then he said, you keep beating the drum for justice. And I was so moved. And he said, come here. And he grabbed me by my jacket, pulled me into his wheelchair. He said, I'm going to show you something. And he turned his head And he said, "You see this scar I have behind my right ear?" I said, "I got that scar in Greene County, Alabama, trying to register people to vote in 1963. He turned his head. He said, "You see this cut down here? You see my scar down here?" He said, "I got that during Freedom Summer in Philadelphia, Mississippi, 1960s. He turned his head. He said, "You see my dark spot?" He said, "That's my bruise." He said, "I got that bruise in Birmingham, Alabama, during the Children's Crusade in 1965. And then he looked at me and said, "I'm going to tell you something, young man." He said, "People look at me, they think I'm some old man in a wheelchair covered with cuts and bruises and scars." He said, "But these aren't my cuts. These aren't my bruises. These aren't my scars." He said, "These are my medals of honor." And I think people who understand the importance of justice understand the importance of making that difficult decision to sometimes do uncomfortable things. But when we understand the true metric system of justice, we understand that that sometimes is the thing that gives us the most meaning when we evaluate our life. And that's how I reconcile that tension. When I go back to Alabama, we've got a bunch of people facing execution dates. We've got a lot of people in need. There will be some difficult moments. But I actually don't mind picking up a few cuts and bruises and scars if at the end of my journey I can say these are my medals of honor.
You might have picked up a few more drummers for justice this evening, Brian.
Thank you.